Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 100 days ago today, Barack Obama took the oath. 44th President of the United States. Now 100 days in. It has been a whirlwind, Obama style.
Starting today, we must pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and begin again the work of remaking America.
We will rebuild. We will recover, and the United States of America will emerge stronger than before.
By August 31st, 2010, our combat mission in Iraq will end.
The United States is not and will never be at war with Islam.
That's a good-looking dog, though. Let's face it.
Great dog.
We cannot rebuild this economy on the same pile of sand. We must build our house upon a rock.
An economy in crisis, big plans on health care, education, energy, huge spending, and a new face abroad. The new president has reached out to old foes and drawn blood of Somali pirates. 100 days is not much, but we've seen a lot. This hour on Point, what we've learned in 100 days about this new president and where he will lead. You can join the conversation. What's your take on President Obama's first 100 days? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. She won the Pulitzer Prize in 1995 for No Ordinary Time, her history of FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt. Her 2005 book, Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, was a New York Times number one bestseller. She's written acclaimed histories of LBJ and JFK. Doris Kearns Goodwin, welcome good to One Point. It's great to have you today.
I'm very glad to be with you today.
And with us today from Washington, political analyst, syndicated columnist, author, three-time presidential candidate, and leading conservative voice, Pat Buchanan. He served as senior advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, and Reagan, ran himself in 92, 96, and 2000. His most recent book is Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War, How Britain Lost Its Empire and the West Lost the World. Pat Buchanan, welcome back to you as well. It's been a while. Good to have you, sir.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. Good to be with you and Doris.
It's a day. It's a day on the calendar. They say it was nothing. It's a Hallmark message, but it's 100 days, and we've got a lot going on here. A lot has been pumped out by this administration. Doris, FDR kind of set the table for this 100-day examination. You knew that presidency. You've been watching this presidency. What's your first take on what you've seen?
I think probably he rivals FDR in terms of the scope of his ambitions, in terms of grasping the reins of power with relish. He seems to be enjoying the job immensely, as FDR did. There's a certain moment at which somebody said to FDR, why would you want to be president with all those terrible challenges you have to face? He laughed. He said, who wouldn't want to be president? Greatest job in the world. And you get the feeling that this man, like Ronald Reagan, in a different way, in a different philosophy, enjoyed the job. You get the feeling he's trying to stamp his own schedule the way he wants to. For example, they said about Ronald Reagan that somebody told him when he first came in, the National Security Advisor is going to be waiting at 7:15 in the morning for you. He said, well, he'll be there a hell of a long time because I'm not going to be there. And so, too, with President Obama, he wants to take those kids and make sure they get off to school before he goes into the Oval Office. He seems to have a self-confidence. I think we've seen that, too. Even putting Hillary Clinton in, people said, oh, my God, she'll overshadow him. Hasn't happened at all.
Pat Buchanan, it has been a jam-packed schedule. What's your big take on this president out of all that activity in these 100 days, Pat?
Well, Barack Obama said during the campaign that he wanted to be a transformational president, much like FDR and Ronald Reagan, who took the country in different directions, but moved very dramatically and boldly. And I certainly think he has lived up to that. The centerpiece of it all, I think, and where he's going to stand or fall, is this economic program. He's got the $800 billion stimulus package. You have a budget of $3.5 or $3.6 trillion, a deficit of $1.8 trillion this year, stretching out as far as the eye can see. The question, Tom, is going to be, will it work? I mean, an awful lot of folks believe that too much money is being pushed into the system. too much spending's being done, that folks abroad are not going to lend us the money we're going to borrow. But I think that's going to decide the fate of this administration. But I do think he's moved dramatically, and he's moved boldly, and he's certainly moved with great confidence. Abroad, I think he's made a dramatic impression. I don't know how much he succeeded. He didn't get any help from the Europeans on Afghanistan, where he has doubled down and made Afghanistan Obama's war. The situation in Pakistan is getting close to grave. Mm. The situation in Iraq, where he's got very much the Bush policy almost now, with about 3 years before we get out, I think that is getting serious. So I think you've got to give him high marks for boldness in doing what he said he would do, but we really don't know the returns yet on all of these policies.
Pat, as a conservative audience for President Bush, in these 100 days, what's the moment that most impressed you? What's the one that most turned you off?
About, you mean President Obama?
Yes, sir.
I think what impressed me is the boldness of it and the fact that he has come out, if you will, come out of the closet as a much more dramatic liberal president than I thought. I noticed a poll today came out and said that 59% of the American people now believe he is liberal or very liberal. So that surprised me, and it certainly impressed me. I don't agree with the direction where he's gone, and I'm terribly afraid that what we're going to get is a tremendous, once the economy ignites with all this money sloshing around out there, we're going to get a burst of inflation and another series of bubbles and be in worse shape. So I think that's the thing that greatest concerns me. But what I do admire is his boldness.
Doris, FDR kind of made the mold for what a liberal president would be. But I'm reading here Gerald Seib, The Wall Street Journal, writing today, the last couple of days, about Obama, says he likes big and activist government, but he isn't a classic liberal, says Jerry Seib. He's more of a social engineer than a guardian of the old welfare state. Broad stroke, how do you see Obama in those terms?
I think that may be right, what he just said, in the sense that what he's really talking about, I thought the most important speech he made was the House on Iraq speech, mm-hmm. where he said that if we're really going to have an economy in the future that isn't going to fall into this burst and bubble that we just got into, then it has to be built on a new foundation. And that is engineering and restructuring the economy by alternative energy, by aid to education and educational reform, by making sure that somehow we have more regulatory reform and health care, which is sapping away so much money. So I think it's not so much a matter of just caring about the poor, as sometimes people used to define liberals, mm-hmm. or those who are less well off, but making the economy work for everybody, and thereby, and that's the old idea of the Republicans, trickle down, mm-hmm. but he thinks if you can change the way in which taxes are paid, if you can change regulation, then a true, robust economy will indeed help all parties, middle class and poor alike.
Jerry Seib points out, Pat, I wonder what you think, that one place where Obama seems determined to use government power is to address the inequality of income that has developed in this country over recent decades. I mean, there he seems very deliberate, very determined, more to come on that front. But that does bring shades of FDR to mind.
Yeah, it's not only that. It's the conservatives believe he's something of a neo-socialist in this regard.
Maybe you in particular, Pat. I'm looking here. You call it socialism, pure and simple. This is going to be the battle royal to decide whether the United States takes the greatest leap ever seen toward government control. Pat Buchanan.
As I said, my conservative friends always say we're headed down the road to socialism. I think we've gone right through town and we're on the other side here. But when you take the economy and you take the federal government, I believe this year is going to spend 27% to 28% of GDP. It's traditionally hovers at about 21%. And you get the 12% or at the state and local level, put those together, and you've got 40% of GDP. I think it's pretty fair to say we're at least partially really into this socialist road. But you're exactly right, Tom. By the time he's done with these tax reforms, my understanding is close to 50% of all wage earners will be dropped from the tax rolls. And the top 1% right now already pay 40% of all federal income taxes, and he's going to increase the burden there. The question is,
of course, they've been doing all right for quite a while, that top 1%.
Well, they've been doing fine, but I think if you take a look at them right now, what they would like is to have their capital losses be directly deductible, because that's what they've had in the last 6 months.
Yeah. Doris Roosevelt. FDR is often described as the guy who saved American capitalism by bringing in the reforms that kind of buffered the worst excesses and put it on a path that did pretty well in the 20th century. How do you see Obama vis-a-vis FDR in those terms?
I mean, I think that's what would be resembling both Obama and FDR together, and Teddy Roosevelt, too. We've had periods in history where the robber barons, or maybe the Wall Street people this time, went excessively and didn't share what they were getting with the rest of the country and took excessive, whether it's bonuses or salaries. We saw that in the period right up to the progressive era. Teddy Roosevelt came along. People thought he was a socialist, to go to my friend Pat Buchanan. We could call a lot of these people, and yet he helped to temper capitalism. FDR absolutely felt. That's why he was so mad that people were so mad at him from the business world. He said, I've saved capitalism from itself, trying to make it stronger by regulating it so that it was more fair to more people. And I think that's what President Obama is trying to do as well. And I don't think we called FDR a socialist. Mm-hmm. We're now calling LBJ, we called one. Now we're calling him. I don't
that's
think the word
helps
us.
That's a lot of socialists in the capitalism
and so
seems
far,
to keep
the
on rolling.
Capitalism still keeps going.
How about the pace of these 100 days? Has there been anybody in this pace since the time of FDR?
I don't think so. I mean, you could look at LBJ's second 100 days in 1965, mm-hmm. after he'd gotten the Desegregation Act through in 64. People said, you better go slow now. You have to absorb this change in the country. He said, no way. I've got the momentum. So what did he do in 65? He laid the groundwork for education reform, for Voting Rights Act, for immigration reform, for Medicare, for National Endowment of the Arts, and for so many things that became his trademark, because he knew time was short. And I think that's what President Obama thinks as well, because there's nobody other than LBJ in that second 100 days that even comes close to what Obama's done.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at President Obama at 100 days in office with historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, author most recently of Team of Rivals, with me here in the studio. And with us from Washington, Pat Buchanan, political analyst, syndicated columnist, leading conservative voice, author most recently of Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. Right from the start, in his inaugural address, President Obama was making big pledges to the American people.
We will build the roads and bridges, the electric grids and digital lines that feed our commerce and bind us together. We will restore science to its rightful place and wield technology's wonders to raise healthcare's quality and lower its cost. We will harness the sun and the winds and the soil to fuel our cars and run our factories. And we will transform our schools and colleges and universities to meet the demands of a new age.
100 days in, there he is at the inauguration. What kind of presidency do you think this is going to be? Pat Buchanan, what about the pace and the amount of initiative on the table? There's a great big boardwalk now going here. People said too much, too much, too much. But what do you think?
I agree. I think it is too much. And I think Doris's analogy or comparison with LBJ in 1965 is very, very good. Lyndon Johnson won a far more dramatic victory by 22 points than Barack Obama did. And I recall I was a young editorial writer at the time, and we got basically one shot at each of his proposals, and then it would sail through. I think he had more than 300 members of the House of Representatives. But he took on too much. He did too much. At the same time, he too doubled down in a war in Vietnam. So that by the time I was with Richard Nixon in 1966, Johnson, who had this tremendous coalition, lost 47 House seats and a half a dozen governorships and Senate seats. And in 1968, of course, his party was torn apart by the war in which he had involved himself and by the perception on the part of the American people that all this spending had not worked. We had riots in the streets and all the rest. I don't predict that, but I do sense that he has overloaded the circuits dramatically in economic terms, that the amount of spending and money, with the Fed doubling the money supply, that he is risking an enormous explosion and a backlash politically in 2 years and real problems in 4 years. Now, if it works, there's no doubt about it, he is going to be a transformational figure. But I recall Lyndon Johnson, frankly, I remember those years, 66, 67, 68, when I was with Richard Nixon, and he was a beleaguered president.
LBJ, with that great big agenda and things got in trouble, Doris, on the other hand, Here we're looking at Obama, and Americans polled in October of last year, only 17% said the country was on the right track. Now it's, what, 48, nearly half? That's a huge swing in a short time, and that while he's laying all this out. I mean, it is a lot, but maybe this is the way to transformation. Maybe you've got to put a lot on the table to get everything rolling.
In fact, I think what that poll shows, which is an amazing poll, that just the mere presence of a president in that office has made people feel confident about the future of their country and whether they're on the right track or not. Mm. They probably needed a whole lot of action because they felt like things had come to a stalemate. And he somehow has persuaded them that things will get better under his watch. I mean, FDR was able to do that as well. There's this great funny letter that was sent into him at one point saying, my dog is lost. I've lost my job. My roof fell in. My wife is mad at me. But you're there. Now everything's going to be okay.
What about Pat's cautionary tale in LBJ? Do you see parallels there? The same risk or different dynamics?
No, there's some parallel. But the real parallel is that Vietnam came, took all the imagination, the energy away. LBJ knew that some of the programs that were passed quickly were going to have to be reformed. You learn from it. He said, we're just learning how to crawl, then we're going to walk, then we're going to run. Well, they never got a chance to change those programs, figure out what worked, and a lot of them have worked. We look at Medicare, that's still there. The Voting Rights Act, absolutely essential. National Endowment of the Arts, I would think, Pat may disagree, a very good thing. And immigration reform, which took place at that time. So this signature legislation that took place, but once the war came, and that's, of course, the cautionary tale for President Obama, the outside world comes in ways you can never imagine. LBJ used to say, I wish it could just go away, the rest of the world. I just want to deal with us here. But that doesn't give you that lot.
No chance. I mean, last week, the Taliban, 60 miles from Islamabad, the capital of nuclear-armed Pakistan. I mean, how do you rate the risk of this Afghan or AFPAC effort, as they're now calling it, effort, swallowing the Obama agenda?
It's very scary. We have a son who's a captain over there in Afghanistan right now.
Your son.
Our son, yes, our youngest son who joined after September 11th and then was called back into the Army, and he's now in Kabul working in strategic communications. But he's been in Washington this week, so we've been listening. It's a tough road they're going to have to fight. But, I mean, his argument is that Taliban has to be fought. Whether or not we can fight them successfully given this Pakistan problem is a very scary possibility.
Let's get some callers in here from Des Moines, Iowa. Sophia, you're on the air, Sophia. Hi.
Oh, hi. Thank you for having me.
Sure. What do you think?
I'm ecstatic. I just think that a lot of people, if they really stop and think, President Obama has been consistent with every one of his campaign pledges, and he's laid the groundwork, I think, with, you know, environmental legislation, the Lilly Ledbetter Act, ending the war, his work at the G20 summit. I mean, everything he's doing, he's being true to himself. And I think what's also good to keep in mind is that all this talk about him being such a leftist, he's got a lot of the liberal left that's not happy with some of the things he's done. And I think that's a good thing because it shows that he's a thoughtful president. He's just very thoughtful. He thinks everything through. And I just think that for all the challenges that he has inherited, I think that it's, we need someone transformative. We need someone who's going to take on all of these things. And maybe he's got to do a lot of things at once. There's a lot to handle. He didn't inherit, you know, a surplus and a peace and prosperity. He's got a lot to handle.
Yeah,
I think that he's doing a great job.
He sure did inherit a lot to handle. And there are high marks out of Des Moines. Thanks very much, Sophia. Let's get one from Piscataway, New Jersey. Melissa. Melissa, you're on the air.
Yes. I'm very proud of President Obama. I think he's demonstrated he's capable, he's professional, and he's very pragmatic. I'm most disappointed in the handling of the banking crisis, however. I don't believe that can be thoroughly handled until we break the oligarchies apart.
The oligarchy, how about just the banks for starters? There's been talk about, but we take it, Melissa. Doris Kearns Goodwin, what about it? There have been people who said he should move in more dramatically here. He should temporarily take over the banks. It's happened before. Clean them up, get them back on the market. Even free market people have said this might be the most efficient way. This has been an area of a lot of criticism of Treasury Secretary Geithner and Barack Obama.
I wish, to be honest, I knew the answer to that. It seems to me such a complex problem. And I think the question is, by surrounding himself as he did with people who were very familiar with Wall Street, do we trust that they knew the best thing to do, or was their way of thinking, because they had been partially there for so long, going to be somehow shadowed by that? Obviously, if he took over the banks nationally, then Pat's calling him a socialist would have been a lot more comfortable.
Pat, what do you think on the banking front? I mean, it ties right into the economy. We've got new quarterly numbers out today. Bad again, worse than people expected for the first quarter of 2009. Another sort of negative 6.1 growth. That is bad. How about banking, economic policy here?
Well, that 6.1 growth, it is very dramatic, and it's negative. It's almost as negative as it was in the last quarter of 2008. On the banks, like Doris, I don't know the exact answer, but I think a case can be made for letting some of these banks, if you have to, getting the problem done and solved, taking your beating and reach the floor and then start back up. They seem to have adopted a policy now of all these banks are too big to fail and they're going to feed more and more money into them. And it is on this issue, the bank bailouts and on spending, where the president's poll numbers, where the American people are the most skeptical, even though they're very high on him personally at 80% and they approve of him by 60%. It's on these issues that he's below 50% in terms of the policies he's pursuing. And I think, frankly, the bank situation, it seems to me, until that gets resolved, I don't think anything really goes well.
Jay in Beverly, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi. I find him a demagogic orator. He carries people along with a burst of hope and change, but I feel he's leading the country down a garden path toward ruinous inflation. The best thing I could say about him is that we see perhaps a recapitulation of the ruinous inflation that beset the Weimar Republic in the 20s, and then followed by a program of national socialism in the 30s, where his attempt to control the banks and General Motors and absorbing industry into the government reminds me of Mussolini's catchword phrase, Stato Corporativo Totalitario.
Jay, we've got it. That's a lot of projection, but we've got it. I mean, the risk of inflation is there, Doris. It could come. On the other hand, he inherited this economic meltdown so deep, Keynesians would say you've got to spend to crank it up again. But Jay begins by pointing at, he calls him a demagogue, looking at his oratorical style. And I'm wondering, because I have to say in these first 100 days, he seemed awfully sober to me. I've heard less of that soaring, pump it up, let's go America. We had a little bit at the top of the show, but it's been pretty sober all in all.
In fact, I think if you looked at his oratory, it's almost the opposite of demagoguery, because it's been a patient explanation to people of where the banking crisis came from, what we have to do about it. Some of the times you almost wish that he would be, more the way we heard him in Iowa, that speech when he won the nomination.
Way back in the
primary,
snows. Mm-hmm.
In the snows. There was a real warmth in his voice right then. But he seems to have a tone that fits each different speech. There's a range of his. I think the real question that people have asked, is he overexposed? I don't think so. I think in 24/7, you have to be out there as much as you can to get your message across. But FDR would have argued that if your speeches become routine, they will lose their effectiveness. He used to be asked, why don't you go on the radio every day? It's the only way morale will be sustained. He only gave 2 or 3 fireside chats a year, knowing that if he did become too
routine. Is that right?
Routine,
I mean, in legend, they loom so large, you think it's every Friday night.
He gave 30 in his entire 12 years as president. Huh. And at one point when he gave a very, very good speech, somebody said to him, just go on the radio every day. Morale will be sustained that way. He said, if they ever become routine, they will lose their effectiveness. And to some extent, like Obama gave this great speech the other day, the House on Rock speech, and it didn't get the coverage it might have if it had been only one of 3 speeches. But on the other hand, I think he's made the determination that with so many people speaking out there and with the crisis where it is, that he wants his voice heard in every venue possible.
Pat, compare it to presidencies that you know, the pace of his appearance, of his projecting messages to the American public, and how do you see the quality of that popular leadership in this president, Pat?
I think he is overexposed. I think he's doing too much. He's out there constantly. He's following the Bush pattern, George W. Bush, where they go out almost, a couple of times a week to various settings in the country. And he was holding his town hall meetings and things like that. And I noticed tonight one of the networks, I believe, is not going to cover his national press conference.
Notably, Fox.
I think he is overloading the circuits there. I don't agree with the caller about 1923 in Germany, where, you know, the mark went down to absolutely zero. Mm. But I do believe he is running a very, very serious risk of serious inflation when you've doubled the money supply. Now, Bernanke is following Milton Friedman, whom he told, Milton, you know, you wrote the book. You got a Nobel Prize for saying what we did wrong in 1929. You're right. We're sorry. We won't let it happen again. And I think he's going too far in the other direction. And I do believe and do agree with the folks who say, and I was talking with Senator Bayh today, and there's a real fear of the stagflation, which came in the 1970s under Nixon, when we ran up those huge budget deficits in 71 and 72 for the election. Arthur Burns, you know, gunned the money supply, wage and price controls, and it really ruined the 1970s and helped ruin the presidency of Jimmy Carter when they had to cut back and Volcker had to come in and put the economy through a ringer.
But isn't that the George W. Bush legacy that Obama's now wrestling with? I mean, isn't that the proper handoff to look at here, Pat?
Well, Bush was excessive spending on war and domestic spending both, but his last deficit and largest deficit was one-fourth the size of the deficit we're running this year. The Federal Reserve has doubled the money supply in the last several weeks. Now, they say there's no velocity there and it hasn't ignited, so no problem right now, but as soon as it does, I think you've got this risk, and I think Barack Obama, by doing it all with health care and everything now, I think he's compounding the risk.
Mm. Dora, step back for a second here. I mean, here we have an African-American president, a young president, a president with relatively little time in Washington, D.C. As I listen to both you and Pat, I mean, everybody's saying he has taken the reins. We've seen presidents come in and grapple and struggle. Bill Clinton certainly struggled in that same 100-day period. I mean, when you simply look at coming in and stepping into the role of United States president and this particular man, what do you see?
I mean, think about where we were during the primaries when that most famous commercial, 3 a.m., who do you want to have on that other end of the phone? Or when people worried about he'll be so naive when he goes abroad, he won't know how to talk to the various leaders. He has handled himself with aplomb and with steadiness and with a certain kind of classiness that makes us feel already he is our president. That's a hard transition to make for somebody who was not very well known by the country before this. I think one thing that helped him was the long primary campaign. Mm-hmm. Hillary probably did him a great advantage by getting so many people interested in who was going to win that race that they began to know him more than they would have. If he had won in New Hampshire and then had sort of just sat back until the McCain thing, we wouldn't have had as great a sense, and he wouldn't have been challenged as much. But I think underneath it all, he came into office knowing, he said early on before he even ran, I see a moment in history where this could be a transformational time. He saw it like the Progressive Era, the New Deal, or the Great Society Era, and he wanted to run then so that he could have that. The crisis has made it even more possible for him to do all these things. And the question is, if he does them right, he will be a transformational president. Or if things go wrong, as Pat says, we could be in trouble.
FDR, in his famous 100 days, had a fair amount of bipartisan support. Obama has had almost none. How significant is that?
Well, in FDR's time, the crisis was just so deep by the time he got into there that Republicans said just anything to get movement.
This isn't bad enough this time, for crying out loud.
I must say I thought there'd be more bipartisanship. And I think he tried at the beginning. He brought them over for those Super Bowl parties. Mm-hmm. He spent more time with Congress than many other presidents have done. But that ideological gap between the Republicans and Democrats now on spending, despite Bush's having spent a lot, is so deep that the question will be, can moderate Republicans begin to emerge like we saw Specter change the party and go to the Democrats? That might be a signal for the future, more bipartisanship, if more moderate Republicans pop up.
Emerge or bolt, as
or
we
bolt.
Saw with Pennsylvania's
yes.
Alan Specter. Doris Kearns-Goodwin, please stand by. Pat Buchanan in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking about President Obama's first 100 days in the White House this hour. 100 days. since that inaugural day that everybody saw, everyone will remember. History made there, and a lot going on in the 100 days since. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins us in the studio, author most recently of Team of Rivals. Pat Buchanan is with us, from Washington political analyst, syndicated columnist, three-time presidential candidate himself, leading conservative voice. His latest book, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. Pat Buchanan, let's look at Obama on the world stage. He's been out there all the way to Baghdad itself, had a big reception in Europe, talked with the Latin American leaders. World opinion of the United States seems to have perked up a lot. Is that what we needed? It sure felt like it.
Well, it didn't have anywhere else to go, I don't think. But yes, look, I do agree with Doris on he handles himself very, very well. He's a very likable man. He's a personable man. He's got a Kennedy-esque sense of humor about himself that I find very, very attractive. I agree with some of his policy initiatives with the Russians. I think we were too much in their face. His opening to Iran. All of these things, even loosening up a bit on Cuba and sitting down with them and trying to figure out a way that we can get some benefits for those, for the Cuban people in return for lifting the embargo. I do have one concern, and that was his trip to Latin America, where I thought he really, I could not think of another president who would have sat still and sort of engaged in sort of the camaraderie and the horseplay in which he engaged. At the same time, all these Latin American leaders are basically berating the United States for its historic record during the Cold War years, when many of these people are right virtually in bed with Fidel Castro. And I was disappointed in his performance there. But his initiatives, I kind of agree with, or not only kind of, I think some of them are very, very necessary, but he's got an awful lot on his plate. And to be honest, Tom, I look at this situation in Pakistan, I think you're going to get a military takeover over there. And I think the question is whether the military is going to hold it or whether the Taliban are going to take that place over. Now, this is something that was dropped on his desk when he got here. Yeah. But I think they're the things that are going to distract him horrendously, and mainly that situation in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Pat, you wrote about the president in Trinidad sitting and listening to the what you call the scrub stock of the hemisphere, trash our country, and say nothing. I mean, maybe that's scrub stock. That sounds pretty demeaning, Mr. Buchanan. Maybe that's what he's trying to turn around here, that sense in that part of the world that may be how they've been seen.
Well, when Fidel Castro, these people have murdered thousands and thousands of people. And,
Fidel Castro was not sitting in Trinidad.
No, he was not sitting in Trinidad, but his friends and defenders there, and Daniel Ortega, and some of these people have, look, they are not only enemies of the United States, they're enemies of the values and beliefs of the American people. And the things that Daniel Ortega said there in 50 minutes in berating America for what we have done, I think we're far worse than me suggesting that when it comes to livestock, these things are not of the highest quality.
Doris, what about it? FDR did not have an international crisis. He eventually got one, but he didn't have it when he began. Obama has had both, crisis abroad, crisis at home. Could get really bad, Pat Buchanan says, and everybody basically agrees, the AFPAC front. How do you rate him on his foreign policy front?
Well, I think one thing he's done by the travels abroad is to create a reservoir of good feeling toward America, which was not there before. And even if it's true that he didn't get them to presumably do the things he hoped they would do in terms of troop fulfillment or stimulus spending, whatever it was that they claimed he wanted to have done, he's created a platform so that when he needs to go back to those countries, I think it's a fine line between acknowledging the errors that our country has made and, on the other hand, telling what great things our country has stood for. And I think those things have to be in balance. If you're going to talk to another country, there's a great thing about listening to them, what they've been upset with us over the years with, and acknowledging that, but at the same time reminding them of what we did in saving Western civilization during World War II, for one example. Mm. And I think that's the line he's got to figure out how to balance pretty well.
And what about Americans looking at his performance, whether abroad or at home? I mean, Pat Buchanan here represents No small number of Americans who did not vote for Barack Obama. We still see a lot of polarization in these polls, whether it's on how the American presentation abroad, you know, whether it's like strong and fiery or cooler like Obama, or at home. You know, are we doing the right thing in spending to save the economy, or is it a disaster? What do you make of that ongoing polarization? Never mind the lack of bipartisanship in Washington, but the response from Obama's opponents at home, how significant, how important?
Well, I think it's so interesting to listen to Pat, because I think there's a lot of people like Pat who may disagree substantively with what he's doing, but are acknowledging that they feel good about the kind of leader that's there, about his intelligence and his steadiness and his confidence and his ability to speak to the country. I mean, nobody can deny those communicating skills. And if one's being objective about it, even if you disagree with the substance, that means that people are pretty much, when you look at those favorability ratings, they're huge. And it's not just because they like him. I think it's because they're proud to see a person of that quality and dimension into the presidency.
But
people
when you break
want
it down,
to feel good about the president.
Sure, but when you break it down by party, the supportive numbers are so much higher among Democrats than Republicans. Now, is that a problem, or does the president just have to deal with that? You're always going to have a wide range of opinion in this country and keep on going.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, FDR at the beginning tried to, and he did have some of that bipartisan support in Congress, but he tried to also make his peace with the business community when they would not go along with him. He finally cut his ties to them. He said, you know, then he started really deciding, I'm just going to get my Democratic majority. I'm going to go forward. And it seems like Obama may be making a similar decision if he goes for the reconciliation procedure on the budget rather than trying to get some Republicans along in the short term.
Which means health care.
Which means health care, exactly. And I think that, again, that shows a strength to say, I'm going to do it, damn the torpedoes if I have to, but I would try this other way first. He's going to give them till the fall. And I think, again, that's the way you have to deal. You try to get the bipartisanship. If they can come with you on the takeoff, they'll be with you on the landing. It's much better that way. But if you can't and you believe in the goals that you're setting, then you move forward.
Pat Buchanan, do you think that the Specter defection to the Democratic Party and the prospect of Al Franken coming in from Minnesota means that President Obama may have that controlling majority in both houses, and off he goes here.
It may. It may mean that. I would be interested in some of the Democrats, the more conservative Democrats who are up in 2010, the group that sort of gathered together around Senator Bayh. But, there, I mean, as for Senator Specter, I think he's making a virtue of necessity. He looked at his polls. He was down 20 points to Toomey in the Republican primary, and he said, I can't win this primary. Why don't I go over and try the other one and get that fixed for me by Ed Rendell and the president? And he did. I don't think this is as I said earlier today, the Republicans may have gotten over their migraine headache, and they may have given one to the Democratic Party. Mr. Specter is a very independent individual. I don't think he'll come along on card check, but I do agree he may come along on health care. And I do agree with Doris on this. What Barack Obama is saying, he's like Ronald Reagan on this. He's saying, you know, I want those tax cuts, and I would really love to have the blue dogs with me. And I need some of these folks. But if I have to, I'm going to walk right over the top of you.
And what about Doris's characterizations of conservatives? They may not agree. They may sharply disagree on policy, but they are like this man. Do you agree, Pat? I mean, I've heard an awful lot of fiery anti-Obama rhetoric out there in recent months.
I think Obama, the people that like him is somewhere up around 85%.
Yep.
But there's no question there is a deep ideological divide in this country. The Republican Party feels it went along with George Bush in spending. They're looking at this spending and the money supply and the bailouts, and it goes against the very grain of the one great issue on which all Republicans agree, which is small government, and the private sector is the locomotive that pulls the train. And so I think you have never seen figures of I think there is a 65 point difference between Republican approval of Barack Obama and Democratic approval of Barack Obama. So the Republican Party is diminished somewhat. I saw somewhere it's only at 21% of the people, but they are very solid behind resistance to Barack Obama's agenda.
At 21%. Let's go to Columbia, South Carolina, and Raymond. Raymond, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much.
Sure.
I wanted to comment on the direction the country is going. I do not like it. I spent 20 years in active duty in the Marine Corps. I did not vote for President Obama. My 30-year-old daughter did vote for President Obama.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, I just feel like we are losing too much of our say. We know that the government doesn't work for the people work for the government. They're already putting devices in the homes, and I know in Georgia, the monitors, the electrical.
Raymond, you're breaking up on me there. I got a little something about devices in the homes, and I'm not sure what that is. But Doris, here's the view of too much government in Barack Obama. But and that is out there, and Pat describes a core that sees that, feels that, believes it, resists on that basis. At the same time, there is this kind of hesitance of Obama to be, it seems, fully into that, you know, government overall here.
No, in fact, he came in talking about what he wanted was not large or small government, but government that works. And that's what he will be judged on. If the government becomes some big bureaucratic mess as it handles some of these problems that it wasn't handling before, then of course it's going to be troubling for him and for the country. But if somehow he can bring, I think it's going to depend in part if he can bring in a new group of people who will be able to bring his goals to fruition. You know, in 1960, a whole group of young people came into the government because government seemed to be the solution at that time with JFK and LBJ. Mm-hmm. They're all retiring now. We need to fill so many places in the government, and it's important that the kind of people who care about public service, and maybe some of the people who might have gone to Wall Street will be caring about public service now. They'll become teachers. They'll become public servants at all different levels. But if our talented people can go to the government, and if some of those bureaucratic rules can get reduced so they can have some creativity and inventiveness, then maybe government can take on some of these burdens.
And what about the people right around the president, and what's emerged there in these 100 days? You famously wrote about Abraham Lincoln bringing his team of rivals on board in his cabinet. Here's Obama, right from, you know, his chief of staff on out. What do you see in the team that has emerged as most important around this president?
Well, I think what it showed is that he's willing to bring strong people around him who can question him. I mean, he's got Gates on the one hand, who was a Bush holdover, and he's got Hillary on the other hand. He's got Ray LaHood as a Republican in transportation. He might have brought Gregg on had he been willing to stay. He would have had Richardson, another rival there, if that hadn't screwed up. And so I think there's a strength that he has. And I gather when he talks to the inner circle, he wants them to argue both points of view in front of him, and then he can make the decision. He's not afraid of having people that say you're wrong when discussions are taking place. So hopefully that continues. When sometimes when presidents start out that way and then things get defensive and they hunker down as LBJ did and they want only the personal supporters around them at that point. But I think we're a long way from that now.
Who would you compare this president to when you look back off the 100-day performance we've seen? I mean, not just the pace, that may take us to FDR, but in terms of his approach to leading, governing, the kind of, I don't know, vibe?
Well, I think you can see pieces of other presidents in him. I suppose since I live with all these dead presidents all the time, they seem alive to me. And I think, and I'm interested in Pat's thought about that too, but his communicating ability to the American public reminds me of Reagan. His idea that he has to push through one big thing, which is government becoming more able to help people through this transition, as Reagan thought government was the problem, is a reminder of that. And his optimism and his confidence and somehow the way in which he made the country feel better again reminds me of Reagan. In terms of his activism, definitely it's FDR or LBJ. And in terms of the kind of calmness and the steadiness he has, then that, of course, reminds me of my old buddy Lincoln, because that was the central quality that he had, that kind of calmness in the midst of all that turmoil and a deep self-confidence combined with a certain kind of humility to know that he wanted strong people around him because he couldn't answer every problem.
Pat Buchanan, I want to get you on that. Let's get a call from Mary in Des Moines, Iowa first. Mary, you're on the air.
Hello. Just wanted to say, first of all, I respect all of you immensely, and I'm enjoying this program quite a bit. I had a comment and then a question. My comment is that I feel that comparing the two deficits isn't quite fair. A lot of the deficit that George Bush rang up went to a war that was based on falsehoods. It went to Halliburton. It went to Blackwater. I didn't agree with the way the money was spent. At least Barack Obama, this deficit is going to help his fellow countrymen and try to help all of us as a country and try to improve things for everybody from the, you know, the top to the bottom. And my question would be, when Pat mentions that, you know, he's taking on too much, I would like to know what he thinks he should leave off the table.
Mary, let us pick it up. Our time is short. Pat Buchanan?
Well, I think what Barack Obama said everybody's going to have to sacrifice here, and he talked about bringing this deficit down. I think he's the one that has to look at the programs he's got. He's got national health care, and he's got cap and trade. And education, it looks to me, I mean, George Bush, I think, virtually doubled the spending at the Department of Education and the and the returns are very, very meager, if they exist at all. I think he should put some of these on the back burner, as Senator Bayh said this morning, stretch them out or something. But I would have to leave that up to the President of the United States. I mean, they're all his priorities.
And when it comes to past presidents, we've got 100 days that we've seen here with this president. Who and how do you compare him, Pat?
The coolness reminds me of JFK and the sense of humor. And I really like that. I really liked Kennedy, that style of his. I think the activity reminds me of LBJ's first after his re-election or after his election and the defeat of Barry Goldwater. And I think he probably sees himself as FDR. And there is a bit of Reagan in there and the confidence he has. But again, I think when you get back down to what he is doing, it is much more LBJ than it is Ronald Reagan.
Doris, our time trickles down. We've just got about a minute here. What haven't we got to in your notes, your thoughts on the Obama's first 100 days?
Well, I think the important thing, and I'll just pick up the humor business, because humor means the ability to look at yourself from the outside in, and he seems to have that detachment, which means that you can laugh at yourself. When he was asked about that new fleet of helicopters, and he said, well, I've got a helicopter, and it looks pretty nice to me. And then he said, but then I've never had a helicopter before. You know, that's important. When JFK once was in West Virginia, nobody showed up at a breakfast he was supposed to go to, a rally, and he turned to my husband, the young aide at the time, he said, you know, it's a cold day, it's freezing here at 6 in the morning. If I were these people, I wouldn't show up to see me either.
And what about, I have to ask just in a few seconds, the image of that family, this history-making family in the White House, Doris?
I think that's bigger than we can even imagine. I mean, black Americans say they feel better about race relations since this inauguration took place by the sheer fact that they are there. And that could help a lot of people move themselves to work hard like they did to get where they are.
And yet Barack Obama barely speaks of race. Maybe he doesn't have to.
I think the symbolism is right there for everybody to see. A family that's strong, that has education as its background, that seems to love one another, that really enjoys what they're doing right now.
100 days. We're very grateful to each of you for being with us. Pat Buchanan in Washington, thank you so much for joining us, Pat.
Thank you, Tom.
And historian Doris Kearns Goodwin with me here in the studio. Doris, wonderful to see you. Thanks for coming
in.
Thank
you. Very glad to be here.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. Off we go. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.